Welcome to the Spectator podcast. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. A little more than a year ago, Donald Trump began his campaign to be the President of the United States, to the world's disbelief. But since then, Trump has come from being the joke candidate to being on the threshold of the White House. And here he is speaking to the Republican convention.
I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States. We are going to build a great border wall to stop illegal immigration, to stop the gangs and the violence, and to stop the drugs from pouring into our communities.
So what is next for the presidential contender and for American politics? I'm now joined from the Republican convention in Ohio by Freddie Gray, the Spectator's deputy editor, and by Scott McConnell, founder of the American Conservative magazine. So Freddie, you write in your cover this week that Donald Trump has turned the American right inside out. Is the Republican establishment now prepared to throw its weight behind Donald Trump, now he's their only option?
Well, the funny thing is they sort of have to, but I mean, a lot of the sort of old Republican top brass, as it were, have stayed away. But essentially now the party has had to come behind him. But it's a rather sort of funny and slightly disgusting spectacle to what them trying to pretend that this is a normal candidacy, because it's not. It's a very strange and, as you said in the beginning, it's a joke candidacy that's become the real thing.
Does that mean that the party itself has stopped being a serious party as well? It's no longer a normal party.
Well, I mean, it's still a huge... The Republican Party is still a huge beast. It feels this week as though it's a sort of decaying beast, but it's still this huge institution. So it will either adapt and change to Trumpism or it will die. But the question is, how does it change to Trumpism in a way that will make it electable? And Scott would be better to answer that than me, I think.
I think it's quite possible he could be elected, and it's quite possible that he could transform the party. But also it's possible that he will lose in an embarrassing fashion and the party will shrug him off and go back to what it was before. The thing is what it was before was a party that was increasingly out of touch with a lot of its voting base in ways that are probably familiar to Britons, in that the way maybe Brexit voters felt not represented by Tories.
Yes, I think that's very true, Scott. I think that a lot of the Republicans here are very excited about Brexit. They feel that there's a similar phenomenon going on in Britain as there is in the States.
And Scott, do you think we're going to see a more coherent policy offer from Donald Trump? Or is he, I mean, he's flip-flopped between the two major parties, obviously, and we still don't necessarily really know what he believes in. Do you think that we're going to see a more concrete, coherent offer from him?
I would hope so. I think he has coherent political instincts, but he's had a career as a showman and a businessman, and he's not used to dealing with policy intellectuals, delegating to them, sorting out for himself what he likes and what he doesn't like. It's all, I think he's sort of disdainful of a lot of people like that, whether they agree with him or not. And so, he, in order to win, or certainly to govern effectively, he would have to become more coherent and, form a coterie of policy experts and people like that. And he hasn't done it yet, and there's still time, but it's a story that remains to be written.
And Scott, do you detect amongst Republicans who think that he's not going to win a move already towards thinking about post-Trump, towards trying to rescue the party if he fails to get into the White House, for them to be able to change the party back to one that could field a slightly less attention-grabbing candidate?
Yeah, there's a lot of positioning going on. I think the assumption among political professionals is that he won't win. But that's hedged, of course, because they realized they were wrong a year ago. But some of them have positioned themselves by rejecting Trump, not going to the convention, not endorsing him, expressing disdain for him. And some by a kind of, quiet, cold embrace, saying he's our nominee and, we're the party, and for the good of the party, for the good of the Senate and House races, we're not going to essentially dump on all his voters by saying we dislike him. but it's a cold embrace and formal.
And that is difficult, isn't it, Freddie, to sort of say to the voters who have been energised by Trump and some of the interesting characters you describe it in your piece for The Spectator this week, if Trump doesn't win, that actually things are going to go back to normal. For some of those voters, they'd actually quite like a Trump too.
Yes, well, and I think after 4 years of Hillary Clinton, which looks like it will happen, Trump too might be even crazier and much more nasty than people think Donald Trump is.
Sounds like a sort of box office film that would be even, you know, Godzilla 2 or something like that.
Yes, Trump 2, the apocalypse. Yeah.
You know, there's another possibility, though, which is one that I personally would be great, which was that you have a more normal candidate who embraces a lot of Trump's positions, which, you know, I think have a lot to be said for them, and yet acts, you know, more in the like a normal American politician. That is to say, you know, is polite, it doesn't say racist things, and wants to govern, but wants to govern using a lot of the Trump template.
Freddie, he's
yes,
been.
I think. I mean, I think Trump with coherence would be a successful ticket. But I mean, I think the trouble is that so much of Trump's appeal lies in its sort of postmodern incoherence. and that's the problem for the Republican Party.
And Freddie, just give us a sense of what the atmosphere is like at the convention. Does it feel weird?
It feels very weird. It feels like a sort of the police presence is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, even journalists I've spoken to who've been to a lot of conventions say they've never seen anything like this. There was a lot of anxiety beforehand about some kind of attack. But actually, when you're in the midst of it, you realise...
About a violent attack?
A violent attack because of the cop killings recently and sort of racial tension and that sort of thing. But I think when you're actually in the midst of it, you realise that it's a sort of glory of American democracy, really, is that these people aren't just nasty, you know, maniacs. They're a bit crazy, but they're interesting and they want to have fun. So it's a sort of carnival of bizarre Americana.
And Scott, looking across the Atlantic, America does look quite unstable at the moment. Is that how it feels in America?
Yeah, I think we're in an unstable era in America and through actually in the whole West, in the whole kind of NATO zone, and for a lot of the similar reasons. I mean, you have living standards for working people, which rose for two generations after World War II. Stopped rising or declining, and you have a lot of these stresses from immigration, and you have, you know, a question of how much do you want to be globalist and denationalist, and there, all those sort of chickens are coming home to roost in America, and maybe, you know, 5 years behind Europe, but they're the same themes, I think.
And how has it worked with the crowd, the wheeling out of Trump's family? It's certainly been a social media sensation that Melania Trump plagiarised a chunk of Michelle Obama's 2008 speech. But did it go down well with those watching in the convention?
When she first spoke, everybody thought, oh, she did a great job. And then, you know, I went to bed. And then I realized in the morning that she had plagiarised part of it. And, you know... I don't know whether, I mean, it's a huge media story and everybody who wants to find reasons to mock the Trumps, you know, has having a field day. I don't know how much it affects voters and stuff. I mean, in obviously, I think I wrote today that, you know, if Jackie Kennedy's speechwriter had like lifted some phrases 50 years ago, 60 years ago that were used by someone else, it wouldn't have even been a story. I mean, the people in the know might have like written, you know, an aside about it in a column, but it wouldn't have been taken over Twitter, taking over TV the way Melania's plagiarism has been.
Freddie.
I mean, I felt Michelle Obama's speech, the original speech text was so boring and generic that it may as well have been plagiarized. So, I mean, I think actual real people just, they think Melania's sort of, she seems pretty and nice and she loves her husband. And that cuts through all the media gloating about the plagiarism.
And Freddie, have you overheard much discussion of British politics while you've been over there? You mentioned people getting very excited about Brexit in your piece. What's the view of the British political situation in the Republican movement?
Well, Nigel Farage is coming here, and a lot of people are very excited about him. A lot of young people seem to think Nigel Farage is fantastic. They're all very excited about getting drunk with him. So I think there's a sense that Brexit's happened, and that the populist phenomenon is happening in Britain too, and they're excited about that.
And that was Freddie Gray and Scott McConnell from the Republican Convention. Next, Simon Barnes joins me to chat about wasps. Though they plague picnickers and love our ciders as much as we do, Simon writes in this week's magazine that they are not the public enemies they seem. Simon, most British people see wasps as a real nuisance that come in late summer, get drunk, and then fall into their jam when they're trying to have a cream tea. Why do you like them?
You know, like is kind of too strong a term, in fact. I wouldn't claim any kind of active physical affection, but profound fascination, certainly, and in a way a kind of admiration, because they are remarkable things. There's and in human terms, as well as for their own considerable selves. We see the worst of them when they get they're out on the razzle like sailors on shore leave at the end of the summer. But at the beginning of the summer, they couldn't be more clear in demonstrating all kinds of important virtues like loyalty and sinking self into a common cause. Begins with us when the queen comes out from hibernation full of eggs and she starts making her nest, and then the workers go out and raise successive generations until they can breed sexual forms that then go out and form new colonies. And that's all absolutely fascinating and enthralling. They do all kinds of things that are helpful for humans. They are avid preyers on smaller insect life, especially aphids. So if you've got anything to do with roses and many other forms of more functionally useful bits of plant, then wasps are very important to you in your life. And secondly, wasps are important pollinators. They're the workers feed on nectar as a high energy food, and so they're out there pollinating, and we are going through a crisis in which we are killing off our pollinators in a very reckless and ill-advised fashion. So wasps, getting rid of wasps is kind totally counterproductive in terms of human ambitions. But there's another one as well, which is a kind of a tribute to our own history. And the fact is that wasps invented paper, and paper was one of the most significant revolutions in the history of human culture. When we discovered paper, and it was the Chinese who first discovered it in the Han Dynasty, around sort of 0 AD, but it spread into Europe and finally into Britain in the 15th, late 16th, in the early 16th century. And because of paper, we were able to have a mass culture, a less exclusive culture, a better way of passing ideas on from one person to another. And that came about because of a eureka moment of a Chinese person who's much mythologized subsequently, who looked at a wasp nest, which is made from chewed up wood pulp, and thought, this isn't a nest. This is communication. This is something that we can do to write beautiful poems or a note to the milkman on.
So was the first paper made from a wasp's nest then?
Not literally from a wasp.
No, okay.
Or as anybody knows, I mean, this is distant times, 2,000 years plus. But the process that created paper, but which wasps use, which are chewing it up and spitting it out again, could be replicated by humans and create the same sort of stuff that was in convenient human-sized form.
So they've had a huge contribution to civilization. They are a hugely important part of our ecosystem, as are bees. Yet in our culture, we revere bees. One of my favourite buildings is Manchester Town Hall, which celebrates bees as a sign of the British and Mancunian work ethics in its mosaics. We don't have wasp mosaics, do we? And is the difference between wasps and bees merely that bees produce lovely sweet honey and wasps don't?
I think there's possibly to do with that. The bees create honey for themselves and we steal it. So we're basically celebrating our own opportunism there. Wasps don't create such stuff. They're also tend to be more aggressive in defence of their nests. So they come under the great category of dangerous animals. This animal is dangerous. It defends itself when attacked.
But they also defend themselves not just around their nests, but around food and when they come into contact with humans in a way that the bees don't, because the consequences are obviously slightly less high stakes for wasps than they are for bees. Is that just one of those things that we need to get better at dealing with as people? We need to recognise...
That's what I would say. I mean, wasps are not aggressive unless you bring your aggression out on them. sure, they're trying to drown themselves in your glass of champagne or in your PIMS, which is unfortunate. But when you start flapping your hands around them and getting tense with them, then you're obviously enough, your wasps are going to get tense. And so you're far more likely to get stung by trying to defend yourself from bees than when you are from just saying, shrugging your shoulders and letting them get on with it.
So if you treat a wasp with friendliness and respect, then everything will be fine.
It would be certainly a great deal easier and less fraught.
Thank you very much, Simon Barnes. Next, Theresa May's first Prime Minister's Questions this week was roundly judged to be a success, with the new Prime Minister attacking Jeremy Corbyn very bluntly indeed, and deploying some rare humour. Here she is replying to a question from Corbyn on employment.
I'm interested that he refers to the situation of some workers who might have some job insecurity and potentially unscrupulous bosses. I suspect that there are many members on the opposition benches who might be familiar with an unscrupulous boss. A boss who doesn't listen to his workers. A boss who requires some of his workers to double their workload. And maybe even a boss who exploits the rules to further his own career. Remind him of anybody.
So how has her first full week as Prime Minister been? And how will she deal with the challenges ahead? Joining me to discuss this is James Forsyth and John McTernan, who was a former advisor to Tony Blair. So John McTernan, have you been weeping as you've watched Theresa May enjoy such a comfortable first week as Prime Minister, or do you think this is all a sort of honeymoon period that will disappear very quickly?
No, I weep at the state of the Labour Party and the abject performance of Jeremy Corbyn, who just sort of offers himself up for a beating at PMQs, and Theresa May will clearly relish that every week. I weep also for the shambolic incompetence of the three people she's put in charge of the Brexit negotiations, and I think that is going badly quickly, and it will go worse, much worse over the short term and the medium term. The notion that we're going to try and have quick trade deals means that essentially her government's now committed to the Patrick Minford model, which is no tariffs, no protection for British manufacturing, and the People's Republic of China are very happy to sign a trade deal which is on their terms, not our terms. I think David Davis has shown that his negotiation style is no, and that's it, that's all he says. And for Boris Johnson has got to deal with the trailing racism of his language, and he's going to be confronted with that again and again in America, and unless he's going to avoid America, that's going to be an issue.
And James, we did have a mention of Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's Questions this week, which Theresa May largely ignored. Do you think this is going to be a running theme? She's been asked about it at her press conference in Berlin. Boris was attacked by US journalists when he held a joint press conference with John Kerry.
Well, I thought the most telling thing was about how Jeremy Corbyn just doesn't think on his feet. Watching PMQs, it was very telling that she didn't defend her new foreign secretary. After all, she is the person who has appointed him. Corbyn could have kept going on this theme, and he didn't. And that is, he just sets himself up for her to bash him over the head. And that's the problem. As for Boris, look, I personally, if you read the piece where he uses pickaninnies, it is quite clear he is referring ironically to this vision of what people think Africa is. It is not a racist use of language. I think for Boris, the next 12 to 18 months is quite decisive for him, because either he can get over this and then it's done, and he can show that he can be a figure on the world stage, he can be a serious statesman, at which point he becomes a very credible potential prime minister in waiting, or he can never escape his past. You know, his argument essentially is, look, I wrote newspaper columns for decades. I'm not going to re-argue about every single one of them. I think as for Theresa May, the real bit of what her job as Prime Minister is going to be came in the end of the week. You know, she went to Germany yesterday. She's in France today. Brexit, whatever she wants to dominate, I can't see how Brexit does not dominate her time as Prime Minister. And I thought the very telling thing was when Edward Lee, the veteran Tory Eurosceptic, asked her his question about whether she could guarantee that Britain would get out of the single regulated market, he called it, and free movement would end. She didn't guarantee that Britain would get out of the regulated single market or that free movement would end. Instead, she talked about controls on free movement. Now, some people say, oh, if you haven't got any controls on free movement, it's not free movement by definition. But free movement movement within the European Union has changed quite radically since the Maastricht Treaty, while as free movement within the European Economic Area hasn't, because those changes are changes to do with EU citizenship. So there is, I think the potential for some EEA-style deal is still on the table, given what she is saying.
And James, how have those first encounters with Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande gone for Theresa May?
Well, I think with Merkel, we saw these... There was two very similar style politicians. They are both solid, dependable politicians who've got past the kind of flashier, more charismatic politicians in their own party and been consistently underrated by those politicians. The way in which Theresa May got to the top has some similarities to the way in which Angela Merkel got to the top of her own party. I mean, the May-Merkel talks seem to have gone well. Merkel is sticking to a line that she is not going to discuss with Britain the nature of a deal before Britain invokes Article 50, but she's also accepting that Theresa May needs some time before she decides when to invoke Article 50. I think the meeting with the French will be much more difficult, because while the Germans want to give us time, the French do not, and that will be a much bigger diplomatic challenge for Theresa May. But I think she has one advantage, is that she comes at this as a relative clean skin, and she also, because she didn't campaign for OUT, she doesn't have to go through explaining these things. She can kind of slightly turn up saying, look, reluctantly, look, I've got to do this. Let's try and do this in the way that works best, both for us and for the EU as a bloc. I think one of the fascinating things to see is, does she try and capitalise on the differences within the EU and try and use those to Britain's advantage?
And John, does Labour have any role in this at all, in these discussions about Brexit, or is it in such a mess that it really can't contribute?
Look, a diligent opposition would be tabling the questions that have to be answered. So how can the Nissan workers in Sunderland be guaranteed continued FDI? How can students across the country be guaranteed continued access to Erasmus? How can universities be guaranteed continued investment into science research and the spin-offs from that? Just tabling all the demands and saying, you've got to answer these questions, and not saying we have an answer to it, but saying you have to have. So harrying in that way. And also, a better connected Labour Party that used its network of sister parties would actually have relationships with ministers in France and in Germany and able to use that. Because one of the things about Theresa May being quite a clean skin is she has no existing relationships to cash in with the leaders or the foreign secretaries or anybody, nor does Boris Johnson. We don't have very strong networks around the current government or around the opposition, sadly, to connect with the leading politicians, not the first rank, but the second, third and fourth rank politicians who can shape the politics and maybe shape the reception in different countries. And so we need to develop a European politics on the Tory side and the Labour side.
Look, I think one of the ironies of Brexit is it requires us to know a lot more about the politics of other European countries than we have. I mean, one of the problems, I think, with the renegotiation was we failed to appreciate some of the domestic political imperatives that were operating in these other countries and use them to our own advantage. I think there is a rather revealing anecdote that when David Cameron went to his last European summit, he basically said to European leaders, look, you guys are going to have to deal with this free movement problem. And if you had given me my emergency break, Britain would still be in the EU and I would not be a dead duck prime minister. And afterwards, Angela Merkel took him aside. And what I think is quite interesting was, I think some people on the British side were expecting a kind of, oh, I'm sorry, David, maybe I shouldn't have made that phone call to you telling you never to put free movement on the table. And she said, David, don't beat yourself up. You are never going to get an emergency break. And I think one of the things that we find hard to understand in the UK is how much the principle of the freedom of movement means even to those politicians like Angela Merkel, who are not as emotionally attached to the European project as some others. And I think this is where things are going to carry on. Why I'm sceptical of the kind of David Davis view that you can just turn up and say, look, we're not going to do free movement. And so I think you then get into a very complicated conversation, and there's a very complicated conversation Theresa May is going to have with her own party in the country, which is going into the EEA for some period of time while Britain negotiates its own FTA, as in free trade agreement, with the European Union, and therefore accepting free movement of workers, if not free movement of people. Is that an acceptable trade-off? Can you do that? And if you do that, are you going to turn around in a situation where at the next election the voters turn around and say, bloody hell, we didn't get what we wanted, and you see UKIP and the forces of anti-politics making massive gains?
Like, I think that is exactly where we are, which is we know something really big is happening to us. The leader of our country won't define it. She says Brexit is Brexit, and yet everybody knows, whether you're in business or in politics, whether you're in universities or you're in NGOs, you know that nothing is going to be the same at a certain point. That uncertainty is not being resolved week by week in the markets. It's being priced into our banks' shares. It's being priced in by the market. We're going to feel that uncertainty, and that becomes a cost. Some investment decisions are pushed down the line. Some investment decisions just never happen. And I think those things, the slow burn of the effect, and the, if you look at the analysis of where our radical trade deals get us, which is no you know, straight trade deals, no tariff barriers, it is that the hardest hit are those who voted for Brexit because they have the least skills available to move, and their manufacturing is most open to the People's Republic of China. And the people who benefit the most are people like me who live in London, which voted solidly to stay in the European Union. And I'm not, you know, I've got skills, I'm internationally mobile, I'm a white-collar professional. I'm not threatened by...
You qualify on the Australian point system,
yes,
as we know.
Exactly. So we have a situation, an ironic situation, where there's massive uncertainty, which nobody's resolving at a leadership level, but we know the costs will be borne most disproportionately by the areas who voted most strongly to leave the European Union. And the politics of that, in the end, are explosive.
And just finally, James, domestically, we're just about to go into recess. Do you think that Tory MPs are heading back largely to their constituencies in a great mood, or are there many who are angry not to have been promoted or to have been sacked, who are going to brood and come back in September and cause real trouble?
Look, I mean, there are certainly the disaffected from the reshuffle, who are those who would expect a promotion and didn't get it. Some of those who signed up early to the May campaign and didn't get the jobs that they hoped for. And then there's kind of Cameroon disgruntlement, because there was a very foolish thing that they did, which was they were, in the hours after the referendum, they were so angry with Boris and Gove that they basically convinced themselves that Theresa May was the continuity candidate when she wasn't. Actually, in terms of domestic policy, the Boris Johnson-Michael Gove joint ticket was far more continuity. And so you've got those things. I mean, there is broad relief among Tory MPs that they're not having to go back to their constituencies and explain why the Tory party is having a leadership contest that continues until the 9th of September. I think that is regarded as good. I think the other thing she has got going for her, which is another thing which is underappreciated, is I was talking to one Tory veteran, and he basically said, look, this is a very odd time for the Tory party, because at the moment there is no alternative to Theresa May. All the time through the David Cameron era, when things got bad, if Cameron had to resign over Coulson, or if Cameron got hit by the proverbial bus, all of those kind of things, there was William Hague sitting there, eminently qualified to step in and take over as a caretaker leader. It isn't clear right now, if Theresa May got hit by the proverbial bus, who the Tories would turn to. And who is, and that is one of the things that she has working in her favour, which is that there isn't really an obvious person, so there is no point agitating against her straight away. But I think that one of the things, that the challenges for her, is the Tory party itself is deeply divided on the kind of Brexit that there should be. And so, you know, this is not going to be a simple time to be Prime Minister. She should enjoy her honeymoon, which I think will last up until Tory conference and maybe all the way up until Christmas if Article 50 is not invoked until next year. But her government is going to be defined by the hard slog of Brexit.
And John, dare I ask what sort of summer Labour MPs are going to have?
A torrid one, but they will share one thought with Tory backbenchers, which is they'll be grateful there's no general election coming. But I think the leadership campaign will be bitter. Corbyn's threat basically today is that mandatory reselection is going to be brought in, and as a consequence that means if you do the wrong thing, which 172 of them have already done, you'll be thrown to the mercy of Momentum, which is a merciless beast. So the fight for the soul of the Labour Party and leadership campaign, whatever the result is, the fight won't stop, because if you're about to be deselected by your members, then that focuses the mind on whether you're going to hang together or hang separately. So watch essentially for a bitter and brutal debate, but there will be policy debate, and Owen Smith is leading that policy debate. But that won't really matter, because the people who joined the Labour Party in the last 48 hours have not joined for a policy discussion. They've joined to save Jeremy. And that projection of all their progressive hopes onto a frail figure who cannot perform in front of Theresa May is going to be the thing which is in the back of the minds of every single Labour MP, which is, I've got to fight with these people who don't believe that the metric that I have of success is a proper metric of success.
And that was John McTurnan and James Forsyth. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoyed this podcast, why not try the magazine? Reward yourself this weekend and pick up a copy of the most provocative publication in Britain. We have a new trial offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.